previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Is there a line on that? Is it a make it rain line with the girl from DraftKings? You know, is there a line on how long you can go? What's the over under?
You know, it's a back and forth between how long can I go and how long can the hair product hold out. You know, I've got this thing of hair goop that I use, and you know, the longer the hair, the more the goop, and it's really a race against time.
Yeah, I don't have those problems. I used to.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't anymore. Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. I've got a career. You know, I'm all right.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
All right, let's start with the fact that our friend Ron Flatter from Las Vegas sent me a text last night, and it said, I'm coming to the BWI DMV LSMFT, which tickled me because you have to be old enough to know that LSMFT means Lucky Strike means fine tobacco when they used to advertise for that in the 1950s and 60s. So Flatter said, love to take you and Michael to dinner on Thursday, and I said, I'm unavailable. I'm really sorry. You know, and he said, well, maybe next time. But we like Ron Flatter a lot, and he knows a lot about a lot of stuff, and I'd love to have done it. But
yeah, and I feel terrible now because I'm looking back through text messages, and I see the unread dot, and so I'm sorry, Ron. I will text you back.
Oh, you got the same message?
I did.
Yeah, I got it last night. I texted him right away. So we thank Ron Flatter for that. I want to say something now that is not going to get me particularly in trouble, but I am conflicted on what I'm going to say. This has to do with the sort of wake of the motorboat and Tyler Skaggs. Tyler Skaggs is the Angels pitcher who died a few years back of a drug overdose.
Yes.
And it turned out through the investigations that he was having drugs given to him by people who worked for the California Angels. And Matt Harvey just was suspended 60 days for having supplied Tyler Skaggs with a particular drug. And I understand the law and I understand responsibility. There is a certain nuance here, though, that I think needs to be, and not to change the sentences on any level, but a certain nuance that needs to be understood to see how something like this could happen. The employee has gone to jail. I have lost track of his name. He has gone to jail in the Tyler Skaggs case. And I am not going to in any way endorse giving somebody drugs. I'm not going to do that. But I am going to say that when you're an employee of a team, and Tyler Skaggs is one of the players on this team, and a good player, and a high-level pitcher, you might automatically feel at your level, I got to keep this guy happy. I don't really want to do this, but, you know, I could lose my job. If a player goes to management and says, this guy's a bum, and then doesn't give the details of it on any level. You know, so I understand there was pressure on that guy. Matt Harvey is a teammate. He's a teammate. I think anybody would stand up and say, these drugs are terrible. But the relationship between teammates may create a certain nuanced factor here that sort of persuades them not to necessarily do the right thing all the time. Again, I'm not saying these sentences are wrong on any level, and I'm not saying that anything these people did was right, but I'm saying that there is, you know what I mean? There's like a personal dynamic that goes on here.
Sure.
Between teammates and between employees and everything like that, and somebody could feel, boy, I don't want to do this, but maybe I have to do this. There could be that conflict there. Or do you disagree with that?
No, I think you bring up what is so difficult about this. And I think as you zoom out, you try and look at, okay, what are the outcomes? You're looking at jail time and you're looking at a 60-game suspension,
yeah,
which is essentially 60 days. And on the other side, you're looking at loss of life. So,
yeah,
you know, relative the scale of that, you see what weighs heavier. So you're just trying to come to some answer while not sort of final or satisfying, gives you some closure here, but you're then breaking this down into the hierarchy or the sort of org chart dynamics that exists everywhere. The very clear sort of top to bottom employer to employee? What is your the direct chain of command?
The power relationships.
I think what becomes harder to do is say, when does that shift from being sort of that org chart top down to somebody who is operating outside of the rules of their job? And that's where it becomes, is this on the level of friend to friend, or is this sort of in that in between?
Yeah, it's a little bit, again, it's a little bit more nuanced than I think you necessarily see when you look at it to begin with. Eric Kay is the name of the fellow with the California Angels, who's in, I believe he's in jail. Maybe he's appealing.
The judge, I think, just rejected it in a new trial for him.
Yeah,
I think he's facing a minimum of 20
years. He's going to jail.
Yeah.
And in this particular case, Tyler Skaggs, from everything that I've read, knowingly, willfully, eagerly wanted this stuff and reached out to, obviously, teammates, obviously, employees. You know, it's not one of those things where they hooked him on it in order to take advantage of him. At least it doesn't seem that way to me.
This is just a high-profile example of another wrinkle where you're looking at, you know, medical systems, practices, individuals who are trying to pump these drugs into
There are manufacturers of these drugs who are being fined billions of dollars and going to jail.
Yeah.
You know, and going to jail. I think everybody would say it's a scourge, you know, on America.
Absolutely.
All of these pain-killing drugs. Anyway, I just thought I would bring some of that up. I have one other thing to say. Well, the Nats disappointed me, as always.
A lot of clutch hitting.
They don't hit the ball at all.
Did any of your pitchers give up 5 home runs in one inning?
No. No. No, but... Yeah, there's no but. 5 home runs in one inning. Ivaldi, that's really, truly terrible.
Yeah, it's just
a Cruz was a big threat as you're getting ready to trade him in July. Nice strikeout. Bases loaded.
Yeah.
He doesn't appear to be working out so far.
At least he swung.
The Nats are going, whoever is good is leaving.
Yes.
They'll be sold. They'll be sold in
but
July.
Not to go back to the Barry point, but so last night before bath time, the boys are running around our living room. The game is on silent in the background. Trading positions as they pantomime baseball, hits, plays, running the bases as Josh Bell, Victor Robles playing the outfield, and Juan Soto. And they couldn't be happier.
That's great. That's good for them. Victor Robles actually hit the ball well last night. He hit the ball well. There's one other thing I wanted to get to. Well, I could talk about the hockey results, but I don't know the hockey results. Wilbon, of course, no longer likes hockey because the Blackhawks aren't any good.
Right.
So he's given up on hockey. This is how his mind works. Something happened yesterday that we talked about on the PTI show that I want to talk about now. And I started out the copy that I wrote about it. And this is about how the Carolina Hurricanes are not selling tickets to anybody who's a New York Ranger fan by just denying the ability, given the billing address of your credit card, to buy their tickets. They're not doing it. And my first 3 words, I forgot what they were. But it ended in goober. Small town provincial goobers working for the Carolina Hurricanes are preventing New York Rangers fans from getting tickets. They don't sell out to begin with, but they don't want the Rangers to come in and have a louder presence. It's not just small towns that do this. It's insecure franchises. The Los Angeles Rams did this. Pretty big town, Los Angeles. They did this to keep the San Francisco 49ers fans out. The Washington football team doesn't do this because if they did this, no one would go to the games.
They're happy to sell anyone a ticket.
Yeah, they don't have
a suite level.
They don't have fans
watch
on their
the
own.
Play?
So in order, yeah, watch out for the
want
raw
an expired beer.
Yeah. Just awful. So in order to
PGA championship
have
prices.
Anybody in the gym at all, they have to sell outside.
Yes, they do.
But you know, these tickets, the face value is $100, which is a pretty good deal for playoff tickets.
Yeah.
And so now you have to go to the secondary market, SeatGeek, StubHub, sponsors for this show at some point or other. And the New York fans, I'm sure, you know, if they want to go to these games, they have to be looking at a big number because they have to stay overnight and they have to travel and all of that. They have to get a hotel. And they'll probably do it. They'll probably go to the secondary market. But it's such a cheap stunt.
Feels
it's
like it.
Just the only way you can get a ticket is if your billing address is in North Carolina, South Carolina, or Southern Virginia, which the Hurricanes claim as their fan base. And if that was their fan base, they would sell a lot more tickets. Hockey is not you don't grow up with hockey in North Carolina or South Carolina or Southern Virginia. I'm not against expansion of the NHL. I'm not against their team. I'm against the people who are so insecure that they do this. I think Tampa Bay has done this in baseball. I think they've done this in baseball. They don't sell out on their own, and they prevented other people from buying tickets. It makes you look small,
but small. Actually, I like the idea. I think it's very fitting for hockey, though a true hockey place would say, we don't have to do that because we give it all to season ticket holders and we're not selling it. The bigger issue is, why would people in this zip code or this whatever the square box is, why would they then feel it's okay to turn a profit by selling it on SeatGeek because you are going to get those fans?
Yeah. You get tons of them.
I don't think you can legally prevent that.
Yeah.
I think you create a great opportunity for secondary marketeers.
Yes.
I think you do.
I'm just thinking, I had a coworker up in New Jersey, the boarding school, and they moved down to Carolina. But imagine if you still had family or that connection to that tri-state area, being like, no, we are true Hurricane fans. We happen to have that out-of-state card now where we have those, if it's a family member who's coming in.
I'm rooting for the Rangers now. I wasn't rooting for the Rangers before. I didn't care before, but I'm rooting for the Rangers now, and I'm rooting for Igor Shesterkin to shut them out 4 in a row. I'm rooting for that because this is a small-minded, cheap stunt by a bunch of goobers. I did.
I hope they just pan out and show a 60% filled arena.
My still copy was altered. I wasn't allowed to use the word bumpkin. That was apparently considered a slur.
Over the line.
Over the line, bumpkin. I didn't realize that. But, you know.
What it makes you think of the brilliant marketing move that Susan O'Malley would do. When the Wizards, I guess,
sell the other team.
Yeah. Hey, would you like to see Kobe Bryant play?
Sell the other team.
Yeah.
Yeah. If your team is good enough, it doesn't matter.
You don't have to do that.
It just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
All right. We'll take a break. Andy Beyer.
Yes.
Right. When we return, we'll talk about the Preakness. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
I'll just read this. Your friend Paulie Coconuts here. I've been filling in on bass with a duo called Mission Road out of Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. I've enclosed two original songs that we played, both written by the band's keyboard player, Elliot Simon, and sung by the lovely and talented Christina Alexander. The first song, Keep On Doing, was recorded live at Prohibition Hub in Hagerstown, Maryland on April 30. I played bass on that track. We love Paulie Coconuts.
Yes, we do.
It's called Keep On Doing. There'll be another song later, and it plays in the great Andy Beyer. And we're going to talk about the Preakness, but you cannot talk about the Preakness without talking about the Kentucky Derby and the notion that the Kentucky Derby champion, Rich Strike, is not running. He's not running in the Preakness. Andy, are you surprised by this? Do you have an explanation by this? Are you charmed by this?
I'm not surprised because in the modern day, so many trainers just elect to run in the Derby and skip the Preakness, or vice versa. I mean, they generally don't like to bring horses back in just 2 weeks for two. Very tough races, and it was a rational decision that Rich Strike's people made. You know, the flip side of the coin, one of his main rivals here, Early Voting, chose not to run in the Derby, so he would be fresh for the Preakness. So that's the modern day. But we should talk for a minute about the Kentucky Derby because it was one of the most unbelievable races you'll ever see.
This is what I wanted you to explain, what happened in the Derby and whether or not in your lifetime it's the greatest upset you have ever seen.
Uh, I reviewed my memory files, and I would consider it one of the two most inexplicable results that I've ever seen in racing. One of them was the victory of Mind That Bird in the 2009 Derby, and the other was Rich Strike. You can look at this horse's past performances till you're blue in the face and not see a glimmer of logic behind him. I even made a little bet that he'd finish 20th in the field of 20. Horses aren't machines, and sometimes they will improve without notice, without an obvious explanation. It happens regularly in run-of-the-mill races, and it happens in the Derby. The first reaction I think I had, and most people had, is, well, this is such a fluke that he'll never do it again. He'll finish last in the Preakness or wherever he runs. But then I thought back to the other impossible long shot, Mind That Bird, who won the Derby amazingly, came back in the Preakness and ran a tremendous race, big speed figure, narrowly lost a photo finish to a champion. So, horses can get good and then stay good. I wouldn't have thrown Rich Strike out in the Preakness, and I think, I don't think he's going to be disgraced in the Belmont either.
See, this is interesting. I have written down questions. My next question was to ask you, will he ever win another race? And then it was going to say, why even run him in the Belmont and devalue him? Why not say, that's it, you're done right now?
No, I would say devaluation is not an issue. Let's say everybody is so disbelieving. I mean, my breeders are not lining up, to syndicate Rich Strike for stud duty. I mean, he's got to if he comes back and wins the Belmont, or even runs credibly in it, that will enhance his reputation. But these people seem to like the sport. I'm sure they'll run him all season as long as he stays healthy.
There's a larger issue here that you alluded to. It has nothing to do with Rich Strike. It has to do with the fact that the Triple Crown is set up 3 races in 5 weeks. You win the Derby, you go 2 weeks. You win the Preakness, you go 3 weeks to the Belmont, which is a mile and a half. Is this, if people don't send horses that win to the next race, Andy, do they have to change that? You can't change that. It's 150 years. You can't change
it. Well, they need to change it. I mean, there were one of the issues with the Preakness was that, a former executive there told me was that they didn't want to move the race because that would move it back toward Memorial Day weekend, the start of beach season in Maryland, which would detract from all the screaming college kids, getting drunk in the infield. But I think the timing has to be changed, and you move the Preakness back 1 or 2 weeks, and run the Belmont on the 4th of July, something like that. This isn't rocket science, to change these dates.
Okay.
But the Preakness is just dead as a serious race. Not only did Rich Strike defect, but so did the third place finisher Zandon, who would have been one of the favorites here, and you've got a pretty uninspiring field of 9.
Yeah, Baffert's horses are both not in this. What happens to those horses, and what happens to the famous Tim Dactine, who did not come through?
Tim, I wasn't shocked that those that those horses failed in the Derby. You know, the way the Derby was run, there was such a fast early pace, you know, set by a horse from Dubai who was like a, you know, just a tearaway sprinter, that all the horses close to the lead collapsed. I mean, you know, everybody in the race rallied. That's one of the reasons that Rich Strike was able to win, and the two Baffert horses were among the many that sort of got sucked up in the hot pace.
Okay, the race itself, the guy starts on the far right. He ends up on the far left. If you are Epicenter or Epicenter's rider or Epicenter's trainer, and you are passed on the rail in the last furlong, you have to say, what? How did this happen? I had this Derby on my racket. How did this happen? Am I right, Andy? That was so weird.
Yeah, I don't think it was the fact of getting through on the rail that made a difference. I mean, you know, Epicenter, he made his move to the lead on the turn when he had to go around a couple horses. He ran kind of a normal race, and there was no indication that, you know, that being on the rail was you know, it was a big tactical advantage. It was just, I mean, but the jockey, the jockey on Rich Strike just ran an incredible race. I mean, it was quite something to see. I mean, to
Sandy Leon
to the rail.
Yeah, it was tremendous. I'm interested. You thought the horse would finish last, so you didn't have one of those small moments where you said, "Ah, I'll put $2 on this horse."
Because
the payout on the Superfecta was incredible.
Anybody who's celebrating the Derby said, "Well, I'll throw him in for a few dollars." No, nobody was making speeches about how they liked Rich Strike.
So we're down from 20 horses in the Derby to 9 in the Preakness, which is pretty common. Sometimes the Belmont has 5 or 6. There is a winnowing of the field. Does that make it easier to handicap? Because now I'm going to ask you who you like.
Epicenter is definitely the horse to beat in this race. I'm kind of sorry the race came up so thin, because he was the best horse in the Derby. With that hot pace, everybody who was on or near the lead collapsed. Epicenter actually, you know, stalked the leaders. I mean, he made what now you could look at and say it was maybe a little premature move as he hit the gas to get the lead turning into the stretch. All the other horses who were there at the finish just made late runs picking up the pieces. So I thought Epicenter ran a commendable race in the Derby. I mean, I wish he had some more credible opposition, because I would have, if I could have gotten 2-1 or 5-2 on him, I would have made a bet. But he's going to be a pretty strong favorite.
All right, we will talk to you in front of the Belmont when apparently Rich Strike is going to run again, and maybe we will get back into that drama, because as you say, but this is one for the ages. I mean, that horse, anybody who follows horse racing at all is still shaking his head, right?
Right, and it really seemed to captivate a lot of people. I mean, you know, just, you know, kind of national non-sports TV shows, everybody was talking about the Kentucky Derby because of this crazy horse.
Well, they talked about that. They also talked about it because the guy on the outrider on the pony had to punch him in the face 10 or 12 times to get him to stop eating the pony. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. Andy, no. You must have seen that before, but I've never seen that.
I can't remember it happening very often.
Very well. Thanks, Andy. Talk soon.
Bye, Tony.
Andy Beyer is just
the best.
Just the best. We'll take a break. Steve Sands will join us when we return. He's, I believe, at the PGA, Southern Hills in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Once again, this is sent to us by Paulie Coconuts. This is a song called I Used to Drink Whiskey by, what's the name of the band that he's with? Mission Road.
Mission Road, that's right.
He writes, the second song, I Used to Drink Whiskey, was recorded live at, and get this name, Mountaineer Meat Smokers in Martinsburg, West Virginia on May 7th.
I wonder what they serve.
Mountaineer Meat Smokers. Robert Murphy is featured on the lap steel guitar. We're so grateful to Paulie Coconuts. Michael, if people like Paulie Coconuts want to send us their original music or music they're affiliated with their friends, how do they do it?
Send us your music by emailing it to jingles@tonykornheisershow.com and maybe throw in a smoked turkey leg.
Yeah, that would be good. We'd like to have that.
Yes.
So Steve Sands joins us now. Before we get to Sands, I'm going to read this. It says, while with other littles sharing where they went to high school and the recent talk of Bruce Springsteen, I must share this connective tissue with you in the podcast. I went to Woodward High School in Rockville, Maryland. I'm a classmate and friend of two wonderful friends of the show. First on the list is Gary Braun. Gary was always one of the great guys in the school, although I can attest to his challenge with basic math. Second was our very own real-life Bruce Springsteen, Steve Sands. Steve was our white T-shirt and blue jeans Jeep-driving friend in high school. What many may not know is that Steve was likely the best place kicker in the school's history, and he was money from 45 yards out. He was always one of the good guys. I hope that knowing these two come from the same high school will help trump the fact that so did Dan Snyder. Additionally, I want to share what your show means to some of us out here. As a pastor, recently I was leaving the hospital after spending time with someone who had passed away. It was a devastating situation where I was able to be with this person as they shared their last breath. As I left the hospital, it was a little emotional, as you can imagine, and I needed an outlet to help take me some steps forward. So I tuned into your podcast to hear Greg Garcia break down the Longwood men's basketball team, and it made me laugh as I held back some tears. Your podcast makes a difference for some of us littles out here, and I wanted to make sure you were all aware. Blessings, Scott Bach Hansen, who is a pastor. I'm sure you know that name. I had no idea you were a place kicker. I had no idea. You never have mentioned that.
Well, why would you? You know, it's amazing. You catch all these touchdown passes and all these kinds of things, and everybody remembers one kick you made in high school. It's amazing. I wasn't a very good kicker, but I do remember Scott Bach Hansen. Absolutely remember. I did not know he's a pastor now. That's amazing.
So wait, so you were a football player in high school?
Yeah, I played football. I played football and basketball, yeah.
So and did you
our senior year in high school, if you really want to know this, if you really care.
I do.
Our senior year in high school, Woodward closed the year I graduated. So in 87 was the last year. WJ, Walter Johnson, was the biggest rivalry. It was like maybe a homecoming game, whatever it was, biggest rivalry. Comes down to the end. I played soccer when I was a kid before, you know, going to high school. And the coach always wanted me to kick field goals because, you know, nobody else could kick field goals. I played soccer before I played football. And I made a kick against WJ to win the game. Now, it takes a lot to get the ball down the field. It takes a lot. It takes a guy who snaps the ball, holds the ball. Steve Mead was the holder, and we made the kick. It's a team effort, not an individual pursuit. So I appreciate Scott Bach Hansen saying that I was a good kicker, but I really wasn't that good.
Did you, in fact, dress like Bruce Springsteen? Is that true?
Well, I wore a lot of T-shirts and jeans, just like anybody else. I was a huge, I still am, and it, you know, Liz and I share this together, and you know this. I'm a massive Springsteen fan, always have been. And back then, you know, Bruce was, you know, like sports and music. Bruce was my music. Sports was my world. And Springsteen was my music, and I don't know if I dressed like him or not, but I did wear a lot of T-shirts. I did not have any like goop in my hair, and like Brian Windhorst was talking about yesterday, or anything slick back hair. And, like, I didn't look like Springsteen. I don't know But I did wear a lot of T-shirts, yeah.
This is wonderful when we find stuff out about people like this after years and years and years. It makes me so happy.
Well, you know what's funny is when I was back for the Wells Fargo Championship, I was talking to a couple of high school buddies of mine, and we were joking about the exact same thing. I guess they're rebuilding Woodward High School now. It's a big hole in the ground now, right off of Old Georgetown Road. They're rebuilding a beautiful new high school now. And a buddy of mine was like, you know, this field goal, that field goal. I'm like, yeah, that's amazing. You catch touchdown passes and run routes, and you're a cornerback, and you return punts and kicks. All they remember you 35 years later is that you made one kick your senior year, and it was like you didn't play anything else. Play basketball too. Nobody cares. It's only about that one kick, which makes me laugh. It's nice.
Yeah, if you want, any time you can segue into glory days. If you want, you can do that. It's just you can do that if you want. All right,
with the baseball mitt in my back pocket.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the subject at hand, which is the PGA, and let's get to the question at hand, which is Phil Mickelson. Right. What do you hear? What do you hear about him? When, if at all, do you think he'll play again?
Gosh, I don't know. I thought for sure that this would be the best avenue for him to get back into the fray. It's the most protected you can be is at a major championship in this sport. There's a little bit less access at a major championship. I thought he would sit on a podium or stand behind a microphone, take sunglasses and hat off, and just take questions, get it over with, and go play the first round, talk to the media one more time about it, and then that's pretty much it. Whether he makes the cut or not on Friday, Phil Mickelson's back, and here we go. And he didn't do that. And I thought for sure this would be the best place for him to come back. But he's not ready yet, Tony. It could be that LIV Golf event on June 9th outside of London. If that is the first time he comes back into the world of golf publicly, that is going to cause a big ruckus because he probably will never play another PGA Tour event if that's the case.
What do you think the odds are on that? I mean, Phil Mickelson is not stupid. He'll weigh all this out in his mind. What do you think the odds are that he actually will do that?
I mean, at this point, Tony, I think he might.
Wow.
Unless he's just never going to play again, which I just can't imagine. He'll be 51, let's see, 52. I just can't imagine that he would never play again. But with the PGA Tour, Tony, taking that hard line and not allowing its members, its players, to get a release to compete in that event beginning June 9th outside of London. If a PGA Tour member plays there, he is subject to suspension and maybe indefinitely. Or you can just leave the PGA Tour and go play in that, you know, LIV Golf Series, which Phil could opt to do as well. I just don't know. Honestly, I cannot think of what his on-ramp is now that he didn't play in this event where he's the defending champion here in Tulsa. I don't know. I don't know where he's going to come back.
So the book is out. The Shipnuck book is out. I don't know if anything more is in it. I saw him the other day on the Golf Channel on Live from the PGA. I don't know if there's any scandalous thing in it. But there is some talk that the gambler, Billy somebody or other, whose name I know you know, that he's writing a book and that he has scores to settle with Phil Mickelson. And then there was this thing the other day with Gary McCord that I read that was in the New York Post, that Gary McCord would bet Phil Mickelson during games about whether he would make a putt or not and throw money off the tower if Phil made the putt. To me, that's just part of the culture of golf. I mean, you know, throwing a $20 bill out of a tower because a guy made a 12-footer does not strike me as something you go to jail for. It's just nothing. But what is your sense of what is yet to come?
Well, Billy Walters is the guy. And Billy is a very famous sports gambler in Las Vegas, maybe the biggest sports gambler of his era. Out in Las Vegas. Billy's book is going to be coming out shortly as well, and if Billy chooses to write some of the things that, you know, we heard that he might write about last year when he started doing this, those will be damaging as well to Tiger. But the Gary McCord gambling thing.
Not to Tiger, to Phil.
I'm sorry?
The Gary McCord. You said to Tiger. You meant to fill. It'd be damaging to fill.
The Gary McCord, gambling thing. Who cares about that? I'm with you on that. That's golf gambling. Who cares? I think it's funny. Actually, I didn't know that. Having sat in that same seat in the booth or in a tower with Gary McCord, I find that fascinating. But the whole thing is just crazy, Tony. I know you don't love that word, iconic. He is an iconic golfer, top 10 player of all time, the oldest winner of a major championship. I heard you talking, I think it was yesterday's show, when you watched live from the night before, and Alan Shipman was on the set, and he conducted himself well, and Rich Lerner asked the right questions, and then Brandel Champlain and Brad Faxon came on. The whole thing, the whole segment was fantastic television. I just can't believe that this has taken place with Phil Mickelson. This isn't a random, professional golfer. This is, the second most popular player and best player of his generation, literally a top 10 player of all time, an absolute legend in the sport. And he's just like vaporized. It's like gone. People talked about it on Monday and Tuesday. I don't think anybody's going to talk about it today at Southern Hills. And then moving forward the next 4 days, he's the defending champion, and no one is ever going to see him or hear from him. And it's just sad. It's terrible.
I'll just say this briefly about the gambling stuff. Everybody sort of knows that Michael Jordan likes to gamble. Michael Jordan, whenever he wants to get in a golf game and you want to say, well, how much are we playing for? Michael Jordan famously says, whatever makes you nervous. Michael Jordan can do that because Nike pays him and should pay him hundreds of millions of dollars a year, because they don't sell a single shoe ever without Michael Jordan. So when you have these astronomical numbers being thrown around, you need to understand how much money certain people have. Phil Mickelson makes $50, $60, $80 million a year on endorsement. So if he gambles and loses $10 million a year, it's shocking to all of us, except it's not to him. Right, because he has that kind of money, and that's what he likes to do. Barkley talks about this. Barkley loves to gamble.
Listen, he probably makes somewhere, I don't know, from 2010 to 2014, but, there are recent numbers that have said Phil has made upwards of $50, $60 million a year. And let's see, in 2010, Tony, he won his third Masters, okay? So he was at the height of his popularity and earning potential. I'm not saying that losing $10 million a year for four consecutive years in gambling is a good thing. But when you make $60 million a year and you lose $10 million, that's 1/6, right, of your salary. If you make $100,000 a year and somebody goes out and loses, somewhere between $7,000 and $15,000 of that $100,000 in gambling, you probably wouldn't go bananas. You hear $10 million a year for four straight years, and you go bananas. So context does matter. I agree with you.
All right. Let me get off Phil for a second and get to Tiger. Wilbon, of course, expects Tiger to fail miserably in this, but Wilbon didn't even think Tiger would get out in the Masters. What are your expectations for Tiger?
Wilbon also voted Devin Booker second in the second MVP race, evidently.
Three baskets at home. Three baskets. Game seven at home. Nice job. What are your expectations for Tiger?
Somebody was asking me last night about this. I don't think he's going to make the cut. I don't know. I don't know why I think that. It's a different cut to make than the Masters, Tony. There are not 89 players in the field.
Best field in golf. It's the best field.
156 players are here. Take away the 20 because of the club pros. I'm not poo-pooing them, but they don't have a chance to win this thing. That's 136 players. It's a lot different than 89 players, which you play against at Augusta. It's a big golf course. It's going to be demanding. The wind is going to be way up on Friday, especially in the afternoon. Tiger's playing early Thursday, late Friday, which with the forecast doesn't look like the better side of the draw. It doesn't look like you want to be on the golf course in the afternoon late on Friday because of the weather. I don't know. I don't have high expectations for him. He has not played a lot of tournament golf, Tony, obviously. I know he played those 4 days at Augusta, and he's stronger now. His ball speed's up, and that's good. I just think that there's a rust factor when you're playing against the best players in the world on a golf course where you're not as familiar like you are at Augusta National. So I do not have high expectations for Tiger this week.
If he were, if he doesn't make the cut, that's not progress. What would you consider progress for Tiger Woods at the end of this tournament?
Progress would be making the cut and somewhat competing, say like a top 20, that kind of thing. At Augusta, he played pretty well the first couple of days, Tony. Remember, he shot 71 that first day.
Yeah.
Then on the weekend, he just ran out of gas physically and mentally, putted terribly. That's a mental thing. Because he was so tired physically, he just lost his concentration mentally. Shot a pair of 78s, has never putted that poorly at a major, let alone Augusta, on Saturday and Sunday. Progress to me would make the cut like he did at Augusta and then play better on the weekend, not get tired. These are all things that you would expect to happen based upon where he's been and where he is now. But to not get tired, to be able to finish out 4 days and see your play on the rise as opposed to seeing it fade away. Because let's face it, he wants to play in Boston in a few weeks at Brookline for the U.S. Open. And then the real shot at winning a major this year would be at St. Andrews, which is in 2 months. And he needs to see some progress, and that would be progress. If he played better on the weekend than he did at Augusta, and that the stamina was back.
So we have talked about Tiger and Phil, who are unlikely to win this tournament. One not playing, one maybe doesn't make the cut. Of the more contemporary golfers, of the golfers who might win, I assume that the greatest amount of pressure in this might be on Scottie Scheffler coming out of the Masters. Hasn't really played since then. I guess he played last week. I assume the pressure would be on him. Is he the guy that people want to look at, or do we just think, no, it's on different players?
Yeah, I think it's on different players. I don't think people are looking at him just yet, Tony. If he wins this week, look out. Now you're talking about a guy who's not just on a heater. You're talking about a guy who's literally, progressing to the point of pure greatness. People don't win back-to-back majors in this sport often. If he does that this week, then we'll be talking about him way more at the U.S. Open next month outside of Boston at Brookline. I think people who will succeed this week based upon the way the golf course is set up are people who have the best short games. Scotty happens to have a fabulous short game. I just don't see him winning back-to-back majors. I see other guys performing well here. I think John Rahm is perfectly suited for this golf course. Jordan Spieth has a chance, Tony, to become the sixth player in the history of the sport to win the career Grand Slam this week. He's won each of the other three one time. His last major win was at Birkdale, the Open Championship over in England, and that was in 2017. But his last two starts, Tony, he has a win at Hilton Head and a runner-up finish last week. Last week almost doesn't count because it was such a shootout. You normally would never see that at a major championship or an event which the golf course, was a little bit more difficult. But he still was a runner-up last week. His short game is ridiculously great. If the putter cooperates, he's hitting the ball beautifully. If the putter cooperates, Tony, Jordan Spieth has a great chance this week. And he's playing alongside Tiger and Rory McIlroy tomorrow morning at 9:11 Eastern time. How about that for a grouping on the first day of the major championship? Spieth trying to win the career Grand Slam. McIlroy trying to get himself back into the fray of the best players in the world in a major championship. He hasn't won one in 8 years. And, of course, the circus that is Tiger. There's going to be a lot of energy on the ground here in Tulsa tomorrow morning.
That's interesting because those guys can handle that. There are other golfers who would be unnerved by playing with Tiger, and those guys will be fine, right? They'll be fine with that.
I totally agree. And Tiger has made it that way, Tony. We've talked about this before, me and you, on and off the air.
Yeah.
When Tiger was at his best, he pummeled Phil and Ernie and VJ and David Duvall and Retief Goose and all those guys, and I mean iced them on the golf course, never made them comfortable, never made them feel as if he even realized that anyone else was in the group. Nowadays, Tiger's much more congenial, much more emotional on the golf course, much more acknowledging of the people and the guys he's playing with, because he's allowed himself to get much closer to today's players. He's kind of like the big brother to all these guys, especially the South Florida guys who live in that Jupiter area where he lives. Spieth will be very comfortable in that group. Might not play great, but he'll be very comfortable because Tiger will allow him to be comfortable. And McIlroy, the same thing. McIlroy was there, remember, when all the fans were coming down at Eastlake on the 18th hole in that final round, when Tiger won for the 80th time in his career on the PGA yeah. Tour, the Tour Championship. Rory played in that group with Tiger and said he learned a lot that day and also learned how to become more comfortable with Tiger in the same group that particular day. So Rory and Jordan will be perfectly fine on Thursday and Friday. They might not play great, but it won't be because they're uncomfortable. They'll be perfectly comfortable with Tiger on Thursday and Friday.
Thank you, Steve. And next time we see you, we'll get a football out. We'll just have you kick for us and we'll film it. It'll be great.
I don't think I could even get an extra point over the bar right now at my age 53. But you know,
you never know. You never know.
Scott Botkanson with an email. Wow. Yeah, who's forgetting that name? Wow. Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Sands, boys and girls.
You got it.
We'll take a break. We will have email and jingle when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Makes me so happy. That's the actual Mizzou marching band. It just makes me so happy. Nigel, you want to do Bethesda Bagel?
Yes, Bethesda Bagels. We love them. You will as well. All you need to do is go to BethesdaBagels.com, forward a location in a DC area nearest you, then pop on in and you'll be thrilled.
Love the lyrics today. Mars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell. And there's no one there to raise them if you did. And all this science I don't understand. It's just my job 5 days a week. And then you sit back and you hear Elton John go, Rocket Man.
Yes.
Thanks to our guests today, Andy Beyer and Steve Sands. Thanks to today's sponsors, Freshly and Sunday. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Odyssey. Get the show through Apple Podcasts. Please leave us a review. I'm going to read a very long email now because I do think it's worth it. Michael, don't we think this is worth
it? Sure.
This is about the great zucchini. It comes to us from Eric Henning. Says, it's Eric Henning, who would love to be the official parlor magician of the Tony Kornheiser Show with my very own David Aldridge moment.
Careful what you offer.
Not only do I know Eric Knaus, a.k.a. the Great Zucchini, but I co-wrote his very first book for professional entertainers, Kid Show Rockstar. I can tell you a couple of things about the Great Zucchini, and I realize I'm adding parenthetically. This is so local, but I'm taken by it. First of all, he is the most successful children's entertainer in the United States. And has been for some time. He books up months in advance. In fact, if you live in any of the better neighborhoods in the D.C. area and you do not have the Great
Love
Zucchini at your child's birthday party before they start kindergarten, child services will come and take your children away. It's the law. What is Zucchini's secret? He's a 50-year-old toddler. He bonds with toddlers and preschoolers because he knows how they think. Watching him with kids is astonishing. He gets their sense of humor. Sometimes the parents don't understand what he's doing, but they always appreciate that the kids love him. I have a story that illustrates this. One day I got a panicked phone call from Zucchini. Eric, I need you to cover a show for me. My car broke down on I-95 and I can't get there. I said okay and I headed to the Potomac Community Center for a 4-year-old girl's birthday party. On the way, he called me again and said he had a ride and he was about 20 minutes behind me. When the mother came out and saw that I was not the great Zucchini, she turned ashen. I said to her, I've got good news and bad news. Zucchini's car broke down, but he's only about 20 minutes behind me. She began breathing again, and the blood returned to her face. When she told the kids that the great Zucchini was not going to be there on time, there erupted a wail that I can only describe as the kind of keening that must be present at a Joycean Irish wake. I've never heard anything like it, and I pray I never will again. Then she told him he would be there, and the cheer that went up sounded like VE Day. Now, at that point, I'd been entertaining children professionally for about 30 years, and I thought I knew my stuff. I was about to get schooled. I did my show for about 20 minutes and was keeping the kids happy. Everything's going fine, and then Zucchini shows up. Picture this. He's covered in sweat, dirt, and grease from trying to fix his car. His T-shirt is torn. He's wearing gym shorts with dirty socks and sneakers. He's dragging a huge suitcase that's missing a wheel, so it's scraping against the floor. He looked like somebody had taken a hobo off a rail car and told him to do a kid's party. We turned the page. But the kids all knew him, and when they saw him, it was as if Jack Kennedy, Barack Obama, and Jesus had all showed up in the same room at once. They went nuts. I stepped aside and watched him mesmerize these kids for 20 minutes with his wonderful physical comedy, and then another 20 minutes playing games. It was astonishing. And that's when I knew I had to learn from this guy. Isn't that great from Eric Henning?
That's tremendous.
That's just great. Love it. Yeah, let's get to a couple of other things here. From Matt Rousset in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. That is the home of Lawrenceville prepper Bob Ryan ran, if I'm not mistaken. Dear Mr. Tony, I heard you say that if a player on the Nats wears number 58, he won't be around for long. Don't be so dismissive. Former team chemistry leader Jonathan Papelbon wore number 58, so even if this new guy in 58 isn't around much, it's still worth watching to see if he chokes Juan Soto. It's a great email. I did not know that. Jason Fish, Broomfield, Colorado. As a resident adjacent to Arvada, Colorado, let me say the second A is pronounced like it is in hat. Second, let me be one of the first littles to welcome the great John Fitzpatrick to the Mile High region. Hopefully we'll get to see him at the next Ed Butt Happy Hour. Again, we wish John all the luck in the world. From Carl in Oswego, New York. I am fact-checking the Syracuse Post-Standard. Attached is a picture used in the Sunday paper that is captioned Felix Cavalieri, Dino Danelli, Eddie Brigati, and Gene Cornish are the Rascals. Can you confirm that these are the correct Rascals? Apparently, Felix has just published his memoir, and he attended Syracuse University at the same time as Jim Boeheim. Don't tell Saliza. From Dave Kroll. Not Dave Grohl. Dave Kroll from Syracuse, New York. My sister and her significant other, related by marriage, have a beautiful home in Cooperstown, New York, that they rent out every year during induction weekend. It sleeps 10, and it's always rented by an incoming inductee for their family to stay in, because, as you know, the inductees stay at the Otisaga Hotel. This year, Tim Kirkchin's family is staying there. Does this count as a David Aldrich moment? Also, they have a register book there that all the players sign, like Ricky Henderson, John Smoltz, Ken Griffey Jr. So what's the over-under Mr. Kirkchin signs it? Also, I will let Sis know to stock the house with avocados.
Yep, leave a bowl.
Yeah. I drink coffee, not tea. Maybe that's why I stink getting out of the sand as well. From John Donnelly in Enfield, New Hampshire, did the Kentucky Derby winner start a new trend of officials punching champions just after victory? Going forward, will the Butler Cabin ceremony include Fred Ridley looking to get in some licks? Will Gary Bettman deliver a beatdown before handing over the Stanley Cup? I'll hang up and listen. From Pat Murphy. My name is Pat Murphy. I'm a biology teacher from Downers Grove, Illinois. I've been listening to your show for a while now. It's one of my favorite parts of the day. We're studying evolution in class right now. We're on the topic of Kictalic, one of the coolest transitional species to be discovered. Kictalic, I don't know this, is hypothesized to be one of the first organisms to move with four limbs on land and whom all other four-limbed organisms are related to. Discovered by Neil Shubin of the University of Chicago. I got to see him talk at our school a while back. Just thought you'd like a little science. If there's not already an official biology teacher at the Tony Kornheiser Show, I'd love to be considered. Here's hoping the White Sox get it done this year. You can do this. I was not a good biology student.
No, biology was, for non-majors, right?
Yeah, I was a... Yeah, from Brett
Raise
Boyle.
Your hand.
From Brett Boyle in St. Louis. On last Monday's show, Chuck Culpepper mentioned the only person he came across who bet on Rich Strike in the Derby was a woman who said she did so because she, quote, felt sorry for him that no one else was betting on him. Who knew Phil's mom is now handicapping the horses? Sad news from Baskin Robbins, sent to me by David Morris in Charlotte, North Carolina.
This is confirmation.
And it says that the Baskin Robbins officially, because he wrote, I'm trying to find Baskin Robbins Dunkin' Coffee flavor ice cream. Is that anywhere in stock? I'm in Charlotte, but I have family in Washington. Thanks. The response was, "Hi there. So sorry to inform you, but this flavor has been discontinued in grocery stores."
Got to continue it again.
So now there's no point in me even going to the in the refugee Safeway, even looking through Dunkin' Donuts. From our friend Jeff Piggott in West Des Moines. "While I have never opened for The Who, I did once sing the national anthem a cappella at an Iowa Cubs game. Cubs pitching coach Jerry Royce, yes, that Jerry Royce, said good job." From Mary Fay, "Applying to be the official librarian of the Tony Kornheiser Show. I once saw Steve Martin and Goldie Hawn in a restaurant in Concord, Massachusetts, never Revere. They were there filming the movie House Sitter. I freaked out and said something like, 'Steve Martin, I love you. I saw you in Austin, Texas in 1977. So embarrassing for me. And one more from Mitchell. "This is Mitchell May from Erie, Pennsylvania. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that you don't remember me, as it's been 618 days since my last email in which I provided a detailed explanation of how to properly fold a slice of pizza. At the end of the instructions, I asked to be the official Division III tennis play of the show, to which you responded, 'Sure.' I figure you have been anxiously awaiting an update, and I'm here to provide one for you. My teammates and I were able to win the AMCC tournament for the first time since 2012 this year. I went undefeated with my partner at first doubles in conference and also made the all-conference first team at first doubles and second singles, as well as earning MVP. With winning the AMCC, and I have no idea what that is, what conference that is, we get an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. Our region is conveniently being played at Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, which is only about an hour from D.C. So if you have nothing to do on Friday at 2, come and watch us." What is the AMCC? Anyway, congratulations to Mitchell May from Erie.
Allegheny Mountain Collegiate Conference.
There you go. It's D3. Yes. I assume it's D3.
I'm guessing that would
wonderful.
Be.
Wonderful. Yes. Good for him. If you're out on your bike time, everyone, as always, do wear white.
I'm going to solve. All right. Corno Curl Cabinet.
No, dope.
Keep on shooting, so down. Change.